let's tackle that next set of rules. I said there are only 20. You've already got 10 of them. They're the rules of inference, how you take one line or two lines and draw out another line from that. These next set of 10 rules are replacement rules. They're equivalences. So it's, you don't make an inference. But you see that if you have whatever symbolized in one line, it can be rewritten this way and still be the same thing, still be logically equivalent. So let's look at some examples of this so that you get what I'm talking about. The first rule is abbreviated DEM for Augustus De Morgan, because De Morgan formulated this rule in the 19th century. And it looks like this. If we have a not outside the brackets that says not both P and Q are true, then that is equivalent, and this is a new symbol, equivalent to either P is false or Q is false. Now this sign means a two-way entailment. It's not only that if what's on the left is true, what's on the right is, but if what's on the right is true, what's on the left is. So it goes both ways. And here you see that if you put the not outside the bracket, it's denying the connective. Not both P and Q are true, which is the same as either P is false or Q is false. And if we have not either P or Q are true, then that's equivalent to P is false and Q is false. They're both false. If neither one's true, they're both false. If one or the other is false, then one or the other is false. But it also goes this way, understand. The other rules weren't like this, but if you have something that looks like this, you can write it this way. Something that looks like this can be rewritten that way. And that's what these are. I guess the way of thinking of them is that they're rewrite rules. They let you rewrite a line in another form in order to use it in the argument, in a proof. Here's another one, commutation. You probably already know this. A lot of you got this in arithmetic in grade school. If you have P and Q, you can rewrite it Q and P. Obviously, if that's true, that is. And the same thing is true if it's a disjunct. P or Q can be rewritten Q or P. And it goes the other way. They go left to right and right to left also. Here's another one that does this. Association. This is what happens when we have three different sentences in a line. So we have P or Q or R, and P and Q and R, and they can be rewritten. All you do is slide the brackets over. In other words, if the line is all disjuncts, all conjuncts, it doesn't much matter where you put the brackets. You can slide them around. That's what association allows. I think those are pretty clear, pretty straightforward. Okay. Did you get a chance to copy them down? Because I'm going to put some more up. Here we go. Okay. Distribution. Now, this is a rule that has to do with what happens when you've got a line that's mixed conjunct and disjunct. So we have mixed . So it's not all conjuncts, not all disjuncts, but you have a conjunction, you're a
linking P to a disjunction. This is a disjunction linking P to a conjunction.
So how would those be rewritten? What's equivalent? Here it looks like this. P and Q or P and R. If P is true and either Q or R, then either it's P and Q or P and R. P or Q and R. And that's rewritten.
Or. Wish I could ask you if you have any questions, but I hope that the reason that they're equivalent is apparent and just clear to you. One or the other of these has to be true. If it's the P, then you'd have you could have P and P or Q and P or R. If it's Q or R, you could still have the same thing. They're derivable by other rules as well: simplification, conjunction. It's distribution. Transposition means it's called transposition. That means transpose, switch places. It's not transportation. Transposition. P implies Q. Wesley? It's equivalent to not Q implies not P. So for any hypothetical, any if-then, you can switch them provided you add not to, to them both. Right? If P implies Q, then not Q would yield not P by modus tollens. And that's what that says. But if not Q, then not P. Let's do this. I said you can transpose them provided you put a not in front of both of them. But we also get P is equivalent to not P. So anytime you end up with double knots, you can drop them by this rule. If you've gotten two knots, the second one cancels the first one. And it's the same as P. Double negation, that's called. And that's another of the rules. Okay. Material implication. Here's another one. If P is true, Q is. So either it's not P or Q. Because if it's P, it's Q. You get either not P or Q. And that rule is called implication. You're just able to rewrite this way or this way. And material equivalence. Well, I'm running out of room, so I'll take these off and just do the last three. This is called equivalence. And we're going to take P is equivalent to Q is itself equivalent to say that P and Q are equivalent, each one implies the other. It's the same as saying both P implies Q and Q implies P. And there's another way to do it. There's another way it can be rewritten. P implies Q is equivalent to either P and Q are both true, or P and Q are both false. Equivalence means same value, equivalent, same value. We're talking about truth value, whether something's true or false. So P and Q are true, are equivalent if they're both true, but they're equivalent if they're both false too. And that's what this says. Saying that they're equivalent means either they're both true or they're both false. The next one is so simple you wonder why it's even a rule. But it's called tautology. And a tautology is an old Latin word for a statement that just repeats itself and can't fail to be false. Can't possibly be false, can't fail to be true. P is equivalent to not P. That's a tautology. P is equivalent to P or P. Wait a minute. Wherever we have P, we can rewrite P or P if we want. Wherever we have P, we can write P and P, because if this is true, that would be, this is true, this would be, and they're logically equivalent. They can't fail to be just by the rules. And finally, there's a rule called exportation. I left this to last because that has a special use later on, and this is one that's a very useful rule that you will all by itself, but then it has that special application that's coming up later. And then it looks like this. Let's see. Remark. Yeah. No, I forgot what I'm doing here. Oh, let me put it out here this way. Easier to see. If both P and Q guarantee the truth of R, P is true, R is true, Q is true, R is true, then if P is true, then if Q is true, R is. And it ought to be fairly obvious, but it's very helpful to be able to rewrite these, switch these back and forth in these two different forms. Believe it or not, that's all the rules there are. It's not all that bad. Rules of replacement are pretty obvious. Some of these may require some thought to see that they are also obvious, but then that'll arrive, that you'll get there. They're not that hard to memorize. And so I commend them to your care and keeping. You're going to need to know them and know them extremely well. I think I've made that point about as clear as I know how. Let's take a break from rules. Shift the subject and talk about something else for a minute. But something else that I want to bring up now are called informal fallacies, mistakes of reasoning that people make, which don't have to do with the rules. That's why they're called informal. A formal mistake breaks a rule. An informal mistake doesn't break a rule, but it still messes up the argument and makes it no good. And I think that would help us to see what some of those are here. And I jot down, I'm not going to require you to know a whole lot of them, but just a few of them. Because they're ones that occur often, and they're ones that you need to avoid often. You need to recognize them when you bump into them, too. You catch somebody else trying to get away with them. And there's some interesting illustrations of each. I'm only going to cover five. Equivocation. Now, in logic, this means shifting the meaning of a word. So you would use a particular term in the premises of an argument, and then use it in the conclusion. It doesn't really mean exactly the same thing. You've tried to get away with making it look as though the conclusion follows because of this premise, and along with the others. But in fact, you've introduced a new term. It's not the same. Doesn't have the same meaning. Now, outside of logic, sometimes this is used to mean that somebody's lying. Don't equivocate with me, someone says with someone else. But that's not what it means in logic. It has nothing to do with truthfulness. It has to do with keeping the precise same meaning of a word. That needs to be done for the argument to be compelling. If we can show that a term means one thing in a premise and another in a conclusion, then the argument falls apart. Composition and division. This is a little harder, but you can follow this easy enough. If somebody says that each and every member of a certain group of things has a characteristic, therefore the group has the characteristic, that's called composition. You're putting together from each and every individual member of a certain group, and you're claiming that the group has the same characteristic because all the members do. Now, it's not that that's never true. Sometimes it is. It's that it's not always true. So you can't just say every individual piece of this battleship is light. It's under 2 ounces. Therefore, the battleship is light. No. But you can say of a group of people, if every member of that club is wealthy, then the club as a whole is a group of wealthy people. What you need to do is not just say each and every member has this characteristic, therefore the group as a whole has it. You have to show that this isn't one of the cases where that fails. Division's going the other way. The group has a characteristic, and you say, therefore, the individual members must have it. One silly example would be something like this. Squirrels are pretty evenly distributed over the face of the earth. This is a squirrel, therefore it's pretty evenly distributed over the face of the earth. No. The class of squirrels is distributed, not every individual squirrel. So, and once again, sometimes it is true that the characteristic of a group is a characteristic of every member. It's that it's not always so. And you can't simply say, well, the group has it, therefore the individual, or the individual has it, therefore the group has it. You can't get away with that. That's fallacy of composition and division. I'm going to show you famous examples of these arguments after we go through these. And I'll show you a famous example of a proof that God exists that commits this, another one that commits this. And of course, then there's begging the question. I'm not going to show you examples of that because I can, but they're so simple and obvious that not much fun. Begging the question. No, doesn't mean the same thing it does in ordinary speech. In ordinary speech, people use the term begging the question to mean this raises the question that, of the following and so on. Here in an argument, it means the argument's circular. So take a look at this. Here's an argument that's pretty silly. The Bible says God exists. That's true. God wrote the Bible or saw to it that it was written. God doesn't lie, so God exists. Now, this argument begs the question because in order for premise two to be true, God would have had to exist in order to write it. So you see, it's circular. This assumes this, this assumes this. And you go round and round, and it establishes nothing. That's begging the question. Premise two begs the question. That is, the question was, what grounds do we have to believe God exists? And to say, because God did something, no, he'd have to exist to do it. So you've already assumed the answer. And that just leads us to ask the question over again. Now give me a reason for thinking that's true. Not that an argument that silly would persuade anyone of anything, but sometimes an argument can beg the question very subtly. These informal fallacies can be hard to spot. And I'm going to show you some examples of other arguments that do that. And then there's ad hominem. An ad hominem argument is an argument that attacks a person instead of the issue. So somebody is arguing for a certain law. We need a law that says X, Y, and Z. And then somebody says, well, why would you propose a law like that when you violated it yourself? That's got nothing to do with whether the law needs to be passed. It's attacking the person who's proposing it. And in an argument, the same thing can happen. You attack the one offering the argument rather than the argument itself. And then finally, I think it's good if we cover hasty generalization. We see a few examples and conclude, well, they're all like that. One silly example that I saw one time is this. All American Indians used to march single file. Really? How do you know that? Well, the one I saw did. That's pretty extreme. But it illustrates the point, I think. I'd like you to think about these because they are serious. There are things we need to avoid, things we need to look for. And we're going to take a bit of a break, and I'm going to come back and show you two famous arguments that commit these. Each was a proof of God's existence, and then I want to say a few things about the project of trying to prove God's existence with a logical argument.